Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The facts on the ground in Iraq look awful. Voters call the war their number one issue in the midterm elections. Even early, strong supporters call the war's leadership deeply bungled, the current status near chaos, civil war. Sober critics call it disastrous for the United States. By a margin of 46% to 34%, Americans say that Democrats would now do a better job than Republicans in handling the war. But what would the Democrats do? President Bush says they'd cut and run. Democrats say a lot of things, mainly that they couldn't do worse than the GOP. Up next on Point, with a potential congressional majority in their sights, the Democrats' plans for the war in Iraq. We will hear in this hour from Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, from Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee, from Peter Beinart of the New Republic, and Leslie Gelb, who has helped shape plans for Senator Joe Biden. But first, to help us get the lay of the land, we're joined from Capitol Hill by Ann Plummer Flaherty. She covers defense and foreign affairs issues at Congress for the Associated Press. Ann, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And the question, what would the Democrats do on Iraq if they win a majority next week? Is there one answer to that?
Well, I think it's the million-dollar question that everybody's asking, and I think the answer is that the question is what could they do? And there aren't a lot of policy options in Iraq, is what foreign policy experts say. So it's a little bit of a toss-up.
They still won't have the White House. They'll have a Republican commander-in-chief. So we'll look at what their powers are. Give us a sense of the lay of the land here, the range of options that Democrats are pointing to at this point before the election.
Well, up until about a couple months ago, I think that Democrats were a little bit all over the map on coming up with suggestions on Iraq. You had Congressman Murtha of Pennsylvania came up with the idea that we need to pull troops out right away. Then you have Senator Biden's idea that we need to divide Iraq into various sectarian groups.
Sunni, Shia, Kurd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let them govern themselves. And have a limited federal government that would divvy up the oil reserves, for example. But you know, with every proposal comes cost, and foreign policy experts are debating this, and they say, well, there's drawbacks. And the answer is Democrats, up until this point, haven't had to have an answer for Iraq. They've only had to point the finger at Bush, and then that's been very successful. So we'll see what they do with the elections. And they do say that they have at least an initial plan that they've all agreed upon, which is at least begin to pull some troops out to put political pressure on the Iraqis.
So a quick pullout or a slower pullout, but a beginning soon, maybe, in Joe Biden's view, very autonomous regions within Iraq, and a pullout a bit later. What about Hillary Clinton at this point? She's almost seemed like a stay-the-course Democrat at certain points. What's she saying these days?
Well, Hillary Clinton has signed on with what a lot of the Democratic defense leaders have said. Kind of the lowest common denominator that they've all been able to agree upon is to at least just set a date that you begin to pull out some troops. And she backs this. What she says is that we really need to put the political pressure on the Iraqis to try to come up with some sort of solution because the military can't do it.
And what about the actual powers? Let's say, I mean, from the Democrats' point of view, their biggest possible victory next week would be a majority in both the House and Senate. Let's start with that. Mm-hmm. If they got both, what do they actually have the power to do when it comes to war and Iraq?
Well, certainly if they got both chambers in Congress, it would make it easier for them to try to force change. What they've said when we've asked them this question, you know, how far will you go to try to push legislation? Because, of course, with Bush in office, he needs to sign it. And to get a veto-proof majority, you need two-thirds of Congress, and chances are they wouldn't have
that. Unlikely in either House, yes.
Exactly. So we've asked them, you know, what exactly do you think that you're going to do? And Senator Levin, who's led the Democrats, and Senator Reid, who you're going to have on your show later, they've talked about they really want to try to get a bipartisan solution to this. And it might not solve every problem, and it might not be everything that they want, but if they could get the majority of Congress on one page, they could send Bush legislation, and it would be a very loud message to him that he needs to change course.
Bipartisan has not been something we've heard a lot about lately. What's their thinking there? If the Democrats manage to take one or two houses of Congress, that Republicans themselves will suddenly be more interested in a bipartisan approach?
Well, a lot of them are saying that after the elections, more Republicans are going to be willing to step forward and say, okay, I think we need to make some serious changes about Iraq. They've been told, you know, we need to lay low on this. We don't need to admit mistakes on this. But after the elections, I think you're going to see some gloves come off. I think some people are going to step forward and challenge the president more on this.
And what about the real bottom line power of the Congress here, the purse strings? Have Democrats talked, if they had majorities, about cutting off funding for the Iraq War? This eventually happened in Vietnam. Is anyone calling for that here?
It's interesting because it's certainly an option that Congress has. They can really affect foreign policy by doing things such as limiting the amount of money that we provide to the Iraqi government. Of course, limiting the money that we provide to troops, although I don't think that's a politically viable option. Democrats say they absolutely will not touch the purse strings. That's, of course, the answer that voters want to hear. They don't want to hear that Congress, if Democrats take control, that they're going to cut off money for the troops. But that is, of course, an option, and eventually they could go down that path if they feel that Bush is ignoring them.
So a broad range of potential Democratic options, but with some consistent themes about looking to draw down, to draw out. Ann Plumerty Flaherty with the Associated Press in Washington. Ann, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Nashville and two-term Democratic congressman there, Jim Cooper, representing Nashville and the surrounding communities, Tennessee's 5th District. He's a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman Cooper, thank you very much for being with us today.
Delighted, Tom. Thank you.
So we're looking at the polls. They show that your party could pick up a majority in one or both houses on Capitol Hill next Tuesday. If that happens, Congressman, what do you expect the Democrats, the Democratic Party, to propose, to push, to do about Iraq?
Well, first, we need to keep on campaigning like we're one vote behind. We can't take anything for granted. But I do feel that the Democrats will be given a voice in at least one house of Congress. I would suggest that Secretary Rumsfeld, who has offered to resign twice already, I would urge Congress to go ahead and push for his resignation. I think we need new management in the Pentagon.
President Bush said yesterday, Congressman, that he will keep Rumsfeld on, and that's his prerogative. Can Congress, even a Democratic Congress, do anything about it?
Well, we can at least get more accountability. If you read Bob Woodward's book, State of Denial, you'll see how Secretary Rumsfeld has suppressed military voices. He's largely captured the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for two leaders in a row now, General Myers and General Pace. It's really shocking how we've disregarded the voices of our professional military in the struggle.
So Rumsfeld out at least as a push. Maybe that would happen, maybe it wouldn't. Then what? What's the proposal for the actual situation in Iraq?
Well, I think more and more people are looking at at least a soft partition of Iraq. De facto, that's what's happening already. You have the Kurdish Autonomous Region in the north. The Shia seem to be more and more dominant in the Maliki government, and the Sunni want to go their own way. It's a question, really, then, of dividing up the oil resources. As you know, Iraq was always an artificial construct put together by the British. It never existed in prior history, and it looks like the tribal loyalties are already creating civil war in the country. We need to acknowledge that before it's too late.
A soft breakup, of course, as you know, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was National Security Advisor to President Carter, still very much involved in these things. He calls that approach suicidal. He says if we do that, everyone will hate us. Would that be seen as a defeat for the United States to leave a divided Iraq behind, or are you saying it's effectively divided already?
Well, in the Iraqi Constitution, they have provisions for autonomous regions in the country. That's why I say a soft breakup. We do not want to annoy the Turks with Kurdish complete autonomy. There are hazards with the Shia and Iran. But I think that we have to acknowledge that tribal loyalties are trumping their national loyalty right now. The militias are an increasingly dominant force. We may have claimed to have trained 300,000 Iraqi soldiers, but their primary loyalty seems to be to their tribe and to their religion.
Congressman, what would keep a soft breakup, great autonomy for these three sects, from becoming an all-out civil war?
Well, I think we have virtually an all-out civil war today. I think by giving people more regional control, that would help relieve some of the tensions we're currently facing. And we know that it's a mixed country, especially in the Baghdad area, but we're running out of great options here. It's a question of which option would best bring stability to the country.
The president says he's still gunning for victory and has a plan to do it. Democrats are defeatocrats, the cut-and-run party. What do you say to that?
I think that's a false charge. I think the president has been given plenty of time and plenty of money for his approach to work. It is clearly not working. He and his top civilian aides, like Cheney and Rumsfeld, have dramatically underestimated the threat at every opportunity. Our military is weaker today than it was when he took office. That is a terrible tragedy because we're facing real threats now from Iran, North Korea, and other nations.
Congressman, do you think this war, the Iraq War, can be won?
Well, it depends on how you define victory. I think we can bring stability to the region. I think we can avoid a bloodbath in that country, but by underestimating the problem, we will not have a chance of getting on top of it.
I'm joined now from Washington by Peter Beinart, editor-at-large at The New Republic, columnist for The Washington Post, author of The Good Fight. Peter Beinart, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
And with us from New York, Leslie Gelb. Les Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, advisor to all kinds of Democrats, and very currently active in the thinking about plans for Iraq should a Democratic majority come about next Tuesday. Les Gelb, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Peter Beinart, first to you. You say a lot of what we're hearing, maybe everything that we're hearing, before November 7th, next Tuesday, is all kind of kabuki in advance of the real debate on Iraq, among everybody, including Democrats. Where do you see the Democrats headed on the other side if they get some toehold on a majority?
Well, I think that the partisan division that's been set up by the president on Iraq is more fake than real. I think in private, my sense is that many Republicans will take the election as an opportunity to move closer to where the Democrats are now, which is some at least de facto timetable for the drawdown of American troops. And I think that proposals like the one that Les Gelb and Joe Biden have put forward for a weak central government and strong federal regions will also get more of a hearing. I think that George W. Bush is going to lose more influence over this policy, whether he wants to or not, and that the alternatives that will be out there proposed by Democrats and Republicans may not be that far apart.
Les Gelb, we'll look at what you and Senator Joe Biden are proposing, but first this issue of bipartisanship. On the other side of the election, if the Democrats make gains even to a majority in the House and Senate, do you expect some kind of bipartisan agreement here or more bitter partisanship?
Actually, I see more bipartisanship coming, but the partisan angle is just going to be very strong. You have a presidential election that will start the day after these congressional elections, and the Republicans will continue to draw a distinction between themselves, or try to draw one, over Iraq and strength and terrorism. That won't go away. They still believe it's one of their main advantages politically.
The president talks about, he doesn't say staying the course anymore, but this implication is still kind of there, that Democrats don't believe in victory, that they won't go for it, that he will. Is there, before we get your specific plan, one theme in almost all the Democrat plans, views, seems to be begin withdrawal or looking toward a timetable for withdrawal. Is that a fundamental divide between Democrats and Republicans?
You're asking me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think it is a major divide between the parties. That is, the Democrats want to just get out within a year or so, or they want to use withdrawals and redeployments as a device to pressure the Iraqis to take on more responsibility more effectively sooner.
Peter Beinart, how do you see the real options that will be on the table? And again, on the other side of politics, when the campaigning's over, what's the serious range of options, whether Republican or Democrat, that Americans will face?
Well, I think the only card America has to play, really, at this point, is the threat to leave. And I think that that is a card that's going to be played. Presumably, the Bush administration has already made those threats in private, I would imagine. But I think the threats will become much more serious now. But I don't think we should exaggerate even what that might do. The reality is, we've just seen in the last day or two in Iraq, is that America has much less leverage in Iraq than we used to. And even if we were to threaten to leave, it's not clear to me at all that that would lead the Iraqis to come together. It might, in fact, simply lead the Maliki government to depend more and more on Shia militias that now protect it and exacerbate the sectarian divisions.
Let's talk to another leading Democrat on this front. Joining us right now from Washington is U.S. Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island. He's a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, ranking member of the Subcommittee on Emerging Threats and Capabilities. Senator Reed, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Americans are looking forward to a midterm election day and properly asking themselves, okay, if we give this to the Democrats, what would the Democrats do with Iraq? What do you say in response?
Well, over the last several months, along with my colleague Kyle Levin and others, we've tried to suggest a policy which would recognize that the Iraqi government has to make critical political decisions about reining in militias and beginning to provide real services and real employment opportunities for its citizens, and also that we would have to help in that regard, but underlying it would be a stated policy of beginning to redeploy American forces.
Redeploy means withdraw, pull out.
It means initially to redeploy them within the country of Iraq, and then as the situation allows, to begin to bring them out of Iraq. We could base some in Kuwait or Qatar if there is a need for an overwatching force. But the goal eventually is, I think, to turn the bulk of the fighting, the bulk of the security operations over to Iraqi forces. Without that effort, I don't know if the Iraqis will stand up as they should and really make these tough decisions.
But who's going to stand up, Senator? Does redeployment or withdrawal mean essentially clearing the field for an all-out civil war?
Well, what we have to do is consider all the possibilities, and there's a range of possibilities, from fragmentation of the country to civil war, and one might even argue there's a civil war going on at the moment, so that our distribution of troops would be something that wouldn't accelerate those possibilities. Hopefully, they might provide even a better break on some of the fighting that's going on today. But I think that's something we have to be conscious of. We just simply can't decide we're going simply because we want to go.
David Gergen, former advisor to presidents Republican and Democratic, says that the country is being offered a choice between muck and murk on the Iraq war, that neither party is offering a clear path ahead. I mean, how specific can you be? Are the Democrats here? I mean, are you going to set a timetable? Can you tell the American people, you know, here's the line we would draw on the sand, or is it more vague than that?
Well, I think it is more vague because the situation is itself very complicated and complex. One of the downsides of setting a definite date. First, you know, what's the right date? That's not an easy question. And second, you can have people who simply will try to wait you out before they assert themselves. You could have a situation where, if there's a specific deadline, the government of Iraq either decides to take action or say, "Well, we'll just wait." I think it's much better in terms of our strategic and operational interest in Iraq to make it clear to them, not just by private conversations, but clear publicly that we are going to take steps to begin to redeploy. And I hopefully that will start a process where they will begin to reckon that they have to take specific actions.
Now, former Secretary of State and Bush family friend James Baker and Lee Hamilton may be proposing something like that themselves out of this Iraq study group coming up, Senator. So are you saying something fundamentally from what Republicans are likely to offer? Is there a fundamental choice being made by American voters in the voting booth next week, or is this sort of, we can do it, you know, with a GOP wrapper or a Democrat wrapper, but it's going to be more or less the same?
Well, there's a fundamental choice, and I think the biggest indication of that is the president's statement yesterday that he's going to keep Donald Rumsfeld on as Secretary of Defense. Lee Hamilton and Jim Baker study group is a valuable exercise. They might give the president an opportunity to change course, but with the present Secretary of Defense, with the attitude of they have to stay, we've done nothing wrong, there will be no change. And the opportunities afforded potentially by the Baker-Hamilton study group might be once again missed by this president. So I think this race does turn on whether we're going to change the policy in Iraq and in the United States, indeed, also, or whether we're going to continue with these policies.
Senator Jack Reed, Democrat of Rhode Island, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, joining us from Washington. Senator Reed, thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
With us. Peter Beinart, you're a close listener. So do you hear a plan there or a general direction? Do you hear a real distinction?
I think there is a distinction in the sense that the Bush administration has still not gone this far towards saying that they want to start withdrawing troops, although I think they could get there once they're confronted with the Baker plan. But what I think one has to look at reality here, the chances, it seems to me, that America starting a withdrawal is going to lead this Maliki government to crack down on the militias when he has very little power over the militias. The militias could probably have him dead by tomorrow morning if they wanted to have him, if they wanted. It seems to me fanciful. It's not saying that it's the wrong thing to do, but I think we should be realistic about what a withdrawal would mean. It seems to me the chances that a withdrawal would really lead the Iraqi government, the Maliki government, to do things that of which it is patently incapable of doing, it seems to me, has to be faced squarely.
Let's, can I jump in?
Yes, please.
That?
Let's go.
I completely agree with that point. It is the essence of understanding the reality of what's going on out there. I don't like disagreeing with Jack Reed. I think he's one of the soundest guys in the Congress. But in this case, the notion that we ought to be pressing Maliki, he says this and Bush says this, mm-hmm. pressing Maliki to get control of the militias is just way off base. Because the fact of the matter is, these militias are regarded by the sectarian groups to which they are tied as their protectors. And they're not about to give them up. And they're not going to give them up any more easily or readily than the Serbs, Croats, and Bosnian Muslims did in Dayton, as did in Bosnia. And the Dayton Accords, in fact, allowed each of these three groups to retain its own armies after the peace accord. And they kept their separate armies until about a year or so ago.
And you're saying that's a kind of an echo or a presaging the soft partition. But let me ask you, Les Cub, so here you are allied with Senator Joe Biden, looking at what Jack Reed says on redeployment or withdrawal and saying you couldn't disagree more. Zbigniew Brzezinski looks at what you're proposing and calls this approach of the soft partition suicidal. Are we going to have Democrats in a circular firing squad on the other side of the election?
Yeah, well, Zbigniew didn't used to think it was suicidal. A year ago, he wrote a piece in the New Republic, Peter can correct me, that argued for a federal approach. So it's hard for me to understand how he considers it suicidal now. I think Zbigniew was arguing more against outright partition than against a federal approach or decentralization. Am I wrong, Peter?
Peter Beinart?
I think I vaguely remember that's correct, that he did write about wanting a federal Iraq.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners, if I may. A call from Nashville. Montanez is on the line. Montanez, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing this morning?
We're all right. What do you see?
My only problem with all of this is the lack of bipartisanship that we have is bleeding the effectiveness with dealing with Iraq. I mean, the only travesty that we have with a pending election is that we have American soldiers' lives, which are the only true bipartisan cooperative that we have going on in this country right now.
Mm-hmm.
Dying needlessly while these folks are sitting up here fighting over policy, playing the name game over Democrats and Republicans, which is nothing more than lies for votes. Well, if we do not work together as Americans, there will not be any reason to even try to come up with a solution for this war, because we, one, created this together. We must try to defeat this together. Otherwise, what sense does it make?
Montanez, thanks for your call. Peter Beinart, I mean, there it is. Only the soldiers are out there in a unified front. But on the other side, we're still going to have politics. And it brings us back to this issue of whether this can be addressed without bipartisanship, whether bipartisanship is possible.
Well, I think the real tragedy here is that George W. Bush, it seems to me, had ample opportunities to try to bring Democrats into his policy. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt, after he won re-election in 1940, appointed a Republican Secretary of War and a Republican Secretary of Navy, partly for political reasons, because he didn't want to be left holding the bag as he brought America into war. Even from a political point of view, I have never understood why George W. Bush didn't try to replace Donald Rumsfeld with someone who had some bipartisan credentials. First of all, it could have unified the country more, and also it would have inoculated him to some degree from all the blame that he's facing on this Iraq policy. But the reality is he hasn't done it because this seems to be a guy who is unwilling to cede any control, even when it would patently be in the best interest of the country, and I think probably, ironically, even in his own political best interest.
Liz Gelb, so a knockdown dragout all the way to 2008, or the possibility of a bipartisan bridge here?
Look, I agree with your caller 100%. I'm too old to get outraged, and I'm outraged by the fact that we have such partisan politics going on over this war at the expense of those troops in the field and our country's interests. It's ridiculous. And it's not as if George Bush has done anything except make this worse, which deeply offends me.
But let me ask you...
But let me just finish
yes.
the point. It's not that he hasn't consulted with the Democrats. He hasn't even consulted with other Republicans, so much so that a lot of them now have just begun to speak up publicly on their own, like Senator John Warner. I think we're talking about an administration that really is cut off from reality. And the reality to me is, as we talk about what's going to happen in the next 2 years, the reality to me is this administration is going to be, in its mind, in the mind of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, freed of political constraints. They're not running for re-election. It's going to be hard to rein them in, and they show no signs of recognizing the range of problems that we've been talking about here.
So if you get a narrow win, let's say in the House, what difference will it make? We've heard a lot about hearings that may be called on pre-war intelligence and on contracts that have been let during the war. That doesn't sound like a path to bipartisanship, but certainly to accountability.
As long as Bush thinks this is all about his role in history, his great decision that he's got to stand by, it's going to be hard to bring about any compromise bipartisan policy. And Congress will be driven toward legislative cutoffs, although I don't think they'll get that far.
Legislative cutoffs, by that, do you mean the purse strings, cutting off funding for the war?
Yeah, they'll be driven in that direction, talking about mandating drawdowns of troops, but I don't think they'll actually do it.
President Bush on the stump this week in Sugar Land, Texas, Tom DeLay's old turf, himself talking about the war and the Democrats.
You listen to the debate about Iraq, the Democrat plan for success. Well, they don't have a plan for success. It's a serious political party in the midst of a war, and they have no plan for success. They don't even have a plan for victory. Last week, one Democrat senator described her party's position this way: we haven't coalesced around a single plan, but we're in general agreement on the basic principles. She's right. The only principle about which they can agree is get out before the job is done.
Namo's calling from Detroit. Hi, Namo. You're on the air.
Thanks a lot. Hi.
Hi.
I guess I just wanted to say that, we just heard the president speaking and talking about how the Democrats have no plan for success. Well, my main point here is that why aren't the Democrats mouthing back and saying that we had no plan for entry in the first place? I mean, it seems that we've just gone ahead and legitimized the reason for being in Iraq when we had no real reason to go there in the first place. This president misled us into this war, and when the Democrats take over the Congress, they need to hold him accountable for that. Just as in this last 2.5 days, we've been asking, Kerry to be accountable for the mistake he made when he was speaking. I mean, it's ludicrous.
We've got it, Namo. You're saying let's look back in anger a little bit and have some accountability here. Les Gelb, what about it on the hearings front? Do you expect Democrats, if they've got a majority, to call hearings and, call people to account? Is there a comeuppance coming here?
Well, I think they will call hearings. I wonder whether Rumsfeld would show up. He might not even show up. That's happened before. They may just resist the Democrats and and stiff them with the argument that they're not going to be interrogated by people who have given up on success and victory. Bush is really quite capable of doing that.
Peter Beinart, how much accountability could a Democratic majority Congress squeeze out here, if any?
I think some. They will, if they particularly have subpoena power. There's some very energetic Democrats in the House, like Henry Waxman. I have this great kind of fear that about what they're going to turn up, frankly. I mean, we have found out so many awful things about what the Bush administration has been doing in Iraq and more generally since 9/11, even with a totally pliant Congress that has done no investigations, that it actually worries me to think about what Congress might actually turn up in terms of the enormous misdeeds and whether, in fact, Congress might find things that force it to reopen the question of censure or even impeachment.
And Les Gelb,
this is how little trust I have in what the Bush administration has actually been doing in the past several years.
Yeah, I agree that there are all sorts of bodies buried here, but they're not going to let the Democrats overturn them. Even with the subpoena power, they're going to drag their feet and fight this.
What about the president's taunt we heard there from Sugarland? The Democrats don't have a plan for success. What do you say to that, Les Gelb?
Well, you quoted David Gergen a moment ago, that the choice between muck and murk. Mm. I think the muck and murk really are both on the side of the president. The Democrats are offering alternatives. You can argue with them and say, in particular, that the idea of just pulling our troops out within a year is dangerous. And I disagree with that approach. But it's a serious alternative. It's more serious than what Bush himself is doing. The approach Joe Biden and I have put on the table, or Jack Reed and Carl Levin, the serious approaches. Are they perfect? Do they promise victory or success? I don't know. We may be at the point where everything, any kind of success, is difficult. But I think doing what the Democrats have been talking about gives more promise of some kind of success or stability, or at least less harm than the path we're on.
Let me take a call from Charleston, South Carolina. William is on the line. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
Yes. Well, I guess I'm the one person, I guess, who will say I support the president in staying the course, but not in an absolute sense. I certainly think we need to stay there and amend the way we do business, but certainly pulling a Martha Pelosi pullout would be just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, we would have a conflagration there in the Mideast that could destabilize all sorts of states, and even the, quote, apostate ones, including Jordan and Egypt, and, of course, what's going to happen to Karzai, Musharraf. I mean, it's a real powder keg with a lot of powder. And I think we need to be very, very careful about how we approach this. And we need to take a long-term look at what we're doing there in the Mideast.
Do you believe that with a long-term look that you're comfortable, confident in the president's approach at this point?
Well, no, I'm not comfortable with exactly what we are doing now, but we certainly have to amend what we do based upon the tactics and procedures of those we're going after.
Yeah, well, the stakes could hardly be higher. Let us pick that up, William, and thanks for your call. Les Gelb?
I agree with your caller.
Well, take us to brass tacks, then. I mean, I've got people calling, and you know, the theme here is pull out of some kind, redeployment. He says, look at Murtha, look at Pelosi. Wouldn't this just lead to a regional meltdown? Get us into the brass tacks. What's the dynamic? You're saying the positive dynamic that might come out of a pullout. How can you reassure William that that's not just a path to regional mayhem?
Well, I can reassure him that it isn't a path to real regional mayhem, which is why I would like to try these other approaches and why I would like to think hard about the things we can do if Iraq really does begin to just totally fall apart on us. And we can't not think about that possibility.
But Peter,
just one other
yes.
quick point.
Mm-hmm.
And there are things we can do. The United States is a great power, and we can use those powers diplomatically, economically, and militarily in the course of even Iraq falling apart, if we think about it. You know, Bill Clinton, I rarely quote Bill Clinton, but he has a very good phrase for this. He says, to stop and think is not to cut and run.
Stop and think is not to cut and run, quoting Bill Clinton. Peter Beinart, take us as close to the brass tacks as you can get us then. On the other side of the political language and kind of kabuki show here, when it comes to redeployment or withdrawal, which is what that kind of amounts to, what's the argument that this would might work? You know, what's the dynamic that would lead to stability in that scenario?
From a withdrawal?
Yes.
Well, you know, the argument that you heard from Senator Reid is that it will force the Iraqis to make the tough decisions that they're not willing to make. I think the fallacy in that is that the Iraqi government lacks the power to make those decisions. It's not a question of will. The other argument was that we were fomenting this insurgency because there was so much anti-Americanism in Iraq, and there is. But that argument, it seems to me, is weaker today because so much of the conflict is now between Sunnis and Shias, and America has become less relevant. I think that the threat of withdrawal needs to be brandished very aggressively. But where I might disagree with some Democrats is it can only be a credible threat if you're willing to not use it. If you say to the Iraqis, we're going to withdraw under this timetable no matter what, then, in fact, you're not playing the card. There has to be some possibility that you will stay for a bit longer if they start, as an incentive for them, a kind of carrot for them to start to move in certain directions that we would like.
But that sounds more like what the president's men were saying last week. Khalilzad and Casey in Baghdad, the timetable, the kind of exactly that kind of threat.
Well, I actually think that the irony is that the Bush administration is moving closer to where the Democrats are. But where I think that the Bush administration still does not seem to have gone, and I think Democrats would go, is also towards a kind of more no-holds-barred negotiation with countries on Iraq's borders that we do not like Iran and Syria, to see whether we can come to some kind of understanding by which they could be more helpful to us in trying to keep this place from completely collapsing. You know, what frustrates me so much about George W. Bush's rhetoric about victory and success is, you know, we are like a team late in the fourth quarter down by 40 points. And Bush says, the other, you know, put in this new quarterback and he doesn't have a plan for success.
Right.
We cannot, as Les was saying, the beginning of wisdom here is to recognize how deep a hole we are truly in.
Stop and think. Scott's calling from Plainfield, Connecticut. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you today?
We're all right. What do you see, Scott?
Well, what I see is I feel that the Republican Party is running the scare tactics with, you know, cutting and running is out of control. And apparently the Iraqis, in my personal opinion, are not willing to fight for their freedom. In an interview last week with the Marines over in Iraq, they interviewed an older gentleman, and they asked him if he wanted his sons to become policemen, and he didn't want that to happen because he didn't want his sons killed.
They're getting blown up, it seems, by the score practically every day.
Well, absolutely, and I personally feel that the money being spent on this war would, you know, benefit the Americans much better, considering 5% of the loads at the ports are being checked, 1 million aliens are getting to this country each year. And it's not a concept of winning and losing. We're talking about soldiers on the ground who have families.
But, Scott, does it give you any pause when it comes right to the line of withdrawing, pulling out? Are you worried, like William in Charleston, that could mean just a real meltdown? Goodbye to oil, goodbye to all stability, a firestorm across the whole region.
Well, if that did ever come, which I doubt would come to fruition, it would be a world problem, not just a United States problem. You know, the other people in the world have to realize that they also have stake in this also, and it shouldn't just fall on the soldiers of our Americans and the Canadians and the British that are over there.
Scott, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. Let me get another, if I may, from Fairfax, Virginia. Kathy's on the line. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The thing, first of all, I agree with so many points that so many of the speakers have made so far. The thing that enrages me is listening to Bush talk about a strategy for success and a strategy for victory and how the Democrats don't have that. And he thinks just by using those words that we should have faith in something that the Republicans have given us no cause to have faith in. And the Democrats have no reason to think that they're going to have success or victory on the terms that Bush is talking about. Success and victory to me as a Democrat would be trying to find a peaceful way to get out of there, to save some of the American lives, to get people home who are giving their all for our country. That would be success and victory. We've been told over and over again that the war that we have created in Iraq has worsened our country's security, that all the intel intelligence that we now see that Bush was given before the war told him not to go in there, but he continues with his rhetoric about how success and victory will be ours if we just follow the Republicans, when we've seen no evidence of that.
So there's the bring it home impulse again. Kathy, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another from Providence, Rhode Island. Nathan, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've got just a couple points. One is, it's been my experience. I come from a family who's quite conservative. And my experience is, some of your people on the show today have said that it's been too political. But I would argue that it hasn't been political enough.
You mean the debate around what to do?
Correct. And I see that we have a one-sided system right now. And our system works better when it's a two-sided system. And the president has been given a blank check from time to time. And I think we need to throw more of our political debate into this and not be so, what is it, monopolitical or.
Well, you think the Democrats have given George Bush a free ride? They've been awfully critical, especially.
I think they have. I think the legislature, everything, it's been okay. This amount of money, that amount of money, that amount of money, that amount of money.
Yep.
They don't hold anybody accountable. And the other point I'd like to make just very quickly, if I can,
yes,
is what is success in Iraq? That has never been defined. Does it mean as we back away, they're throwing roses at our feet? What is success?
Well, it was supposed to be a stable democracy in the heart of the Middle East that would help to begin transform that region for peace and brotherhood.
Then my follow-up to that is, who believes that it's going to happen? I mean,
yeah. Like, Nathan, we hear it, and we thank you for your call. Let me get one more right here from Chicago. Dirk, you're on the air.
I have two comments, basically.
Yeah.
One was that I find it a little odd that we're still talking about our power to affect events in Iraq when it's plain that we don't have any. I mean, talking about partitioning at this point is kind of ludicrous because Iraq has already partitioned itself. I mean, Peter Galbraith is right. The Kurdistan is essentially an independent nation. The Sunni provinces are in full revolt and have been for 3 years. And
it's already happened, you say, and we hear it. Les Gelb, this goes right to your bread and butter on the soft partition. What are the steps you would take in encouraging that to also encourage an end to the bloodletting?
Mm-hmm.
What can you do?
In the first place, I disagree with the caller and with Peter Galbraith that the country is already partitioned. But I believe it is going in that direction. It is a real danger. Kurdistan has been more or less a separate entity. But even the Kurdish leaders participate in the government in Baghdad.
But you're proposing formalizing a kind of partition.
Let me explain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not proposing breaking it into three separate nation states.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proposing a federal solution, which is the standard way of trying to keep a country together when the major groups within it can't agree on most issues in a strong central government.
This counts on the Shia and Kurds sharing oil revenue with the Sunni. Will they do that? Does the U.S. have the leverage to make them do that?
Look, I don't know whether we can make them do it, but we can say this to them. Right now, if you want to keep it all, and they've got it all, you're going to get 100% of a tiny pie. There's hardly any oil and gas revenues being produced right now because the country is in turmoil. That's the way it's going to be, and it's going to get worse if you deny the Sunnis their rightful share of Iraqi's oil and gas riches. So you're going to get far more to get 80% of a much bigger pie than you are to keep fighting a civil war and get nothing out of it. And we're not going to help you. You'll suffer those consequences. So I think we can make a pretty good argument to them in the context of an overall deal. But you've got to give the Sunnis, in effect, more than they deserve in order to have a shot at developing a viable federal system.
Peter Beinart, we've just got 20 seconds here. A last thought. Does it matter if the Democrats get one House or both majority next week or the margin of victory? Does it make a difference in what they're able to do?
Yes, because this will be a vote of no confidence in George W. Bush. The more badly he loses, the more influence he will lose over the Iraq policy, and the better chance we have of forcing this stubborn, pig-headed administration to actually open itself up to a change in policy that gives us at least some remote shot at preventing total catastrophe.
Well, there's a glimpse of what may be the future. Peter Beinart, editor-at-large at The New Republic, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Les Gelb, President Emeritus at the Council on Foreign Relations, advisor to Joe Biden on the war in Iraq. Mr. Gelb, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.